So we have the pleasure today of having a speaker who needs no introduction. So Aaron Davide Gaero will tell us about holomorphic BF theory and geometric Langlands.
Okay, as the title suggests, I'm going to discuss aspects of the relation between geometric Langlands and quantum field theory with a particular focus on the role of holomorphic BF theory, which is the three-dimensional quantum field theory, which was introduced in Kevin's talk last week. In that context, it arises a topological twist of 3D nickel Chugach theory, but it happens to also play a role in 4D nickel four superior mills. Now, the geometric Langlands program, the global geometric Langlands correspondence, in a few words, is an equivalence of categories associated to a Riemann surface, I don't know, the C, and a reductive group, well, not as G or G prime. This correspondence exchanges relates to different categories attached to the surface and to the group or to the Langlands dual group. The two categories, loosely speaking, are a category of flat connections or the modules on the space of G bundles on the surface, or a category of bundles on the space of flat connections on the surface. The precise statement of the correspondence, of course, requires a lot of very careful algebraic geometry. And I think it's a pretty recent result. And presumably there are many different, slightly different choices one can make of collections of objects on the two sides, which should be dual. But in this talk, I'm not trying to get into any details of these mathematical structures. Rather, I would like to discuss the way that they arise in quantum field theory. And the general proposal of Kapustin and Witten was that this global geometric Langlands correspondence would be a manifestation of S duality of four-dimensional and four superior mills. More precisely, you can consider the A and B twisted versions of N equal four square mills for the group G of the Langlands dual group G prime. These are four-dimensional topological field theories, which are expected to also be related by S duality, meaning that they are literally the same topological field theory. And a topological field theory attaches a category to a two-dimensional manifold. I mean, a four-dimensional topological field theory attaches a category to a two-manifold. The category, roughly speaking, is the category of boundary conditions for the two-dimensional theory that you get by compactifying the four-dimensional theory on that manifold. And so the A-twisted theory attaches some category Z of A to the Riemann surface C, to the two-dimensional manifold C and gauge of G. And the B-twist attaches another category ZB. So it was supposed to be as G prime on the right-hand side. And the consequence of this duality will be that these two categories are the same. And the expectation is that these two categories should be closely related or the same as the categories appear in some version of the global geometric Langlands proposal. The global geometric Langlands correspondence. Now, from the very beginning of this statement, one of the basic objections was that the categories appearing in the geometric Langlands statement use the complex structure of the curve in an important way. First of all, because they are defined using algebraic geometry, but also because some of the important objects inside these categories are defined using the complex structure of C. On the other hand, a topological field theory should produce a category which does not depend on the complex structure of the Riemann surface. Now, the dependence of the categories themselves on the complex structure of the Riemann surface is sort of weak. I mean, on the right-hand side, the B side, the space of flat connections on the Riemann surface is a nice complex manifold, which doesn't really need to know about the contour structure of the curve, unless you try to describe the flat connections as bundles along, equipped with an homomorphic connection. And on the other side of the duality, the space of G bundles on a curve is definitely something which is defined as the contour structure of the curve, but as a space, and you know, at the level of lack of precision I'm talking about now, the space of bundles can also be realized in ways that don't depend on the contour structure of the surface. For example, you can realize it as a space of unitary connections for the underlying unitary group G. And so the categories themselves, although they are presented and defined using algebraic geometry and the contour structure of the Riemann surface, potentially they don't have to depend strongly on that. But as I said, a lot of important objects inside these categories, which are related by geometric Langlands, do depend on the contour structure. Now, the quantum field theory answer to these facts is that although the fundamental theory is topological, it might allow for defects which do depend on the contour structure of the Riemann surface. And often these kind of defects might be used to present an abstract quantum field theory category as an actual mathematical category, or to build objects inside the category. So if the holomorphic defects or the fundamental topological theory are interesting enough, then it might be very natural for the categories to be presented in the way they depend on the contour structure, and for interesting objects to depend on the contour structure. So hence the focus of this talk on holomorphic topological defects and structures in the four-dimensional A and B twisted gauge theories. Any questions? Okay. So as a brief aside, let me just remind you how the categories that appear in geometric Langlands are expected to match the categories which arise in quantum field theory. So a useful approximation, which is not perfect, but gives some, I mean, definitely gave a lot of insight, at least in the initial phase of the development, is that we can approximate the four-dimensional quantum field theory compactified on the Riemann surface with a two-dimensional sigma model in some finite dimensional target space. And that's a useful approximation because sigma models in two dimensions are something we know very well how to A or B twist and how to study the category of brains of. In particular, on the B side, if I have a B model, a B twisted sigma model, which is with some target M, the category of boundary conditions, the category associated to this, will be a derived category of Korean sheaves. And if you take the B twisted for the theory and you compactify it on a surface C, the approximate description is indeed that of a sigma model whose target space is a space of flat connections. And so you cover the statement that the B category associated to C and to G prime should be roughly the categories of coherent sheaves, the coherent sheaves on the space of flat connections.
David, can you say something about the sort of asymmetry of looking at M in one of these pictures and T star of M in the other? Like, how should I think about that?
Yes. So suppose I give you an abstract quantum field theory. How would you gain a mathematical description of the category of boundary conditions? The natural strategy is to sort of describe it, to find some fiber functors, so to also find some interesting collection of objects, such as morphisms with these objects might constrain or fully determine a generic object of the category. So on the B side, we have objects associated to points on the manifold. And if you take Holmes of an abstract deep brain with a skyscraper at a point, you get a roughly a vector space, or better, a complex, which will vary nicely on patches and glue globally with quasi-isomorphisms. And so you land on things like perfect complexes or coherent shifts on M. On the A side, as I mentioned momentarily, there is nothing that knows about points of my target. And I need some other families of brains. And if I'm lucky and my manifold is the cotangent bundle, there is a nice family of Lagrangian brains, which is the fibers of the cotangent bundle. And taking homes with that builds a mathematical structure, which at the end is a D module on the base.
So, you know, maybe would it be right to say that sort of part of what's misleading is it's not the same M on the two sides?
In which sense?
In the sense of you're writing T star M, but maybe you should have said like a symplectic manifold, but then like it's harder to say what the equivalent of D modules is.
That's true. So describing A brains in a generic complex symplectic manifold is hard. And the properties of the categories do seem to depend quite sensitively on how the manifold looked like.
Mm. Yes, Ben, you could.
Yes.
Sorry, you could restore the asymmetry. I mean, I'll say this also in my talk probably. You could restore the asymmetry if you said Fukaya category of T star M instead of D modules on M.
Yes.
And then you're saying like, you're giving a description of the Fukaya category of T star M and coherent sheaves on flat C. Flat C is also something that looks very much like a cotangent bundle, right? It's a twisted cotangent bundle. So in both cases, you're describing things that look like cotangent bundles, just in one of them, you needed to use the polarization, and in the other one, you didn't.
Yes. Part of the reason I'm hesitant to use Fukaya is because I don't understand the physical meaning of wrapping.
Right.
So auto calculations clearly give the right answers. I still have to interiorize why. But yeah, I completely agree. You know, whatever definition of the A brains, whatever way one can capture the A brains will produce a category which will approximate the category in geometric Langlands, leaving aside the problem that, as I will discuss in the next slide, the two-dimensional description, effective description, is not great.
Right.
So, right, anyway, so as I was discussing now, if I had a two-dimensional theory, which is a sigma model, at least a sigma model, and whose target is sufficiently close to a cotangent bundle or a shifted cotangent bundle, then the category of brains is expected to be described by a direct category of D modules on the base. And in the case at hand, the approximation as a sigma model gives you the space of X bundles on the curve, and that is reasonably close to the cotangent bundle, to the space of bundles on the surface. In any case, this two-dimensional effective description is faulty, essentially because the target spaces are singular. And so the associated two-dimensional models also are problematic. So ideally one would do calculations directly using the four-dimensional twisted theories on the compactified on the Riemann surface. This is harder because it's something less familiar, but it seems mathematically doable in the sense that all the calculations involved in determining these categories should be just semi-classical or perturbative. And so in principle, you know, strong enough BV formalism should allow one to answer these sort of questions, to really find the categories associated to which a four-dimensional topological feature associates to a Riemann surface. I'm not saying it's easy, it's a work in progress, but it's the same sort of in the same spirit as the sort of things you've heard in several other talks about finding the topological field theory data for three-dimensional twisted A or B twisted Nikolov-Foggia theories. This sort of program of deriving the categories from four-dimensional theory has already begun, mostly classically, but it should be something that can be brought to a conclusion. And hopefully produce categories which match reasonably well the expected global geometric Langlands categories. Now, another reason to look at four dimensions is that the four-dimensional picture has some extra properties, which are essentially following from locality on the Riemann surface. So a four-dimensional quantum field theory just has much more structure than the two-dimensional quantum field theory, even when it's compactified on a manifold. So in particular, among all the possible objects in this category associated with the Riemann surface, there are some which have a clear four-dimensional origin and sort of form sub-collections which are automatically exchanged by S-duality. And so a lot of the important objects in the geometric Langlands correspondence actually come from this sort of special elements, special objects in the category. So let me give three main examples. First of all, you can take a boundary condition in three dimensions and wrap it on C. That will result in a boundary condition for the two-dimensional theory, for the four-dimensional theory wrapping C. The first possibility is to use a topological boundary condition. And this will give me a certain collection of objects labeled by the choice of topological boundary condition. If you apply an S-duality and you happen to know what the S-dual of the three-dimensional boundary condition is, that will give you a prediction of what the dual object will be in the dual category. And it's possible to decorate this further by adding extra defects at these boundaries. For example, I could add boundary line defects at points on the Riemann surface to produce a whole class of objects labeled by this data. Alternatively, I could use a three-dimensional homomorphic topological boundary condition to produce objects and wrap it on C to produce objects that depend manifestly on the complex structure of C, and which again will be exchanged by S-duality. And finally, I can take a three-dimensional manifold whose boundary is C and just evaluate the four-dimensional topological field theory on the three-dimensional manifold. And the result will be again an object in the category associated to C. This last example is perhaps less useful for comparison to global geometric Langlands because it tends to be not algebraic in the same sense as which is used in the standard geometric Langlands. But it does have some uses, especially in the analytic geometric Langlands context. So I will use it later. Any questions? Okay.
Sorry, can you just repeat that last bit again? What is this? What was that third, the Z of U3?
So
what was U3?
So take a three-dimensional manifold whose boundary is C.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Then the evaluation of the manifold gives you an object in the category for the surface. Uh-huh. But typically, I don't know, on the B side, this would look like a Kecskés-Lagrangian submanifold in the space of local systems. So using the Betti complex structure on the space of flat connections. And so not something that you can easily insert in the standard discussion of geometric Langlands. But in some situations, it can be useful. For example, it allows you to talk about things like I'll discuss it at the end of the talk in the analytic geometric Langlands context. Now, Let me now discuss a bit more how would you get predictions about S-duality of these topological or holomorphic topological boundary conditions. So the basic idea is to start from boundary conditions in the physical theory. The most natural ones and the most studied ones are half-BPS, and they preserve a three-dimensional Nicol 4 subalgebra or the four-dimensional Nicol 4 supersymmetry algebra. And for a large collection of those, we have S-duality predictions from string theory. And on top of that, there is another collection of predictions, which I believe comes out of the recent work on spherical varieties. But I will discuss it later. So there are two different ways to get a boundary condition in the twisted theory out of these half-BPS boundary conditions. The simplest possibility is to embed the three-dimensional Nicol 4 subalgebra in such a way that it contains the A or B twisting supercharges. If you do that, then the three-dimensional boundary condition is automatically A or B twisted as the bulk is A or B twisted. And so this gives you a topological boundary condition. And this can always be done. So any half-BPS boundary condition in Nicol 4 square mills gives you both an A boundary in the A model and a B boundary in the B model. There is an alternative, which is to take an embedding which is not aligned, which does not contain the holomorphic, the A or B twisted supercharges, although it contains the holomorphic twist, an holomorphic topological twist supercharge, and then deform the boundary condition in such a way that it preserves the A or B model supercharges. So this construction is a bit trickier. It depends on the existence of such a deformation. Most boundary conditions do not have such a deformation, but some do. This is actually completely analogous to what I was discussing in the case of 3D Nicol 4 quantum field theories and boundary vertex algebras. In this situation too, you could use some other conditions which are not compatible with A and B twist, but what could be deformed to become compatible. And these sort of boundary conditions, when they exist, they tend to be holomorphic topological. And if the deformation is quite unique, it's reasonable to expect that if you have S dual boundary conditions and you do this alternative embedding, you will get dual, S dual holomorphic topological boundary conditions in the A or B model.
How do the holomorphic topological boundary conditions play with the generic psi parameter? Are some of them compatible?
So if you were to study the general psi parameter, then they will be deformed into topological boundary conditions. Yes, and when you turn on psi, so psi, the generic twisting supercharge of the Kapustin Witten twist is not compatible with 3D Nicol 4 subalgebras. And so you always need to deform boundary conditions if you want to go to general psi for both types of embedding. And so the collection of boundary conditions for general psi is much smaller.
Thanks.
So, sorry for the wall of text. I put a picture momentarily. The simplest holomorphic topological boundary condition appears in the A twist of the four-dimensional gauge theory. And it's what I would call an holomorphic topological Neumann boundary condition, in the sense that it gives Neumann boundary conditions to the gauge field and does appropriate things to all the other fields. This boundary condition is a very important property. If you take the four-dimensional theory in a half space with holomorphic topological Neumann boundary conditions, the path integral reduces to the path integral of a three-dimensional holomorphic topological DF theory. Here I call this a perturbative path integral, in the sense that, there is a very precise sense in which the four-dimensional setup instructs you on sort of which integration contour to use in the patent data for the three-dimensional theory. And most choices sort of are such that you get just perturbative answers. So this allows many calculations in the four-dimensional theory to be mapped to calculations in three-dimensional BF theory. And it's a powerful computational tool. And it's completely analogous to what happens with the canonical cosmotropic brain in the three-dimensional AI model. And indeed, if you take the holomorphic topological Neumann and wrap it on a Riemann surface on C, you will get a canonical cosmotropic brain for the two-dimensional sigma model. It's in the approximation which the sigma model is a good description. So this canonical cosmotropic brain is a brain in the AI model with a property that calculations in the presence of this brain often reduce to calculations in a quantum mechanics whose phase space is the target of the sigma model. In this situation, the phase space of the holomorphic BF theory is the space of Higgs bundles on C, if I quantify it on the Riemann surface C. And so, there is a close connection between the existence of this D brain and the fact that you can describe other brains as D models in some approximation. This statement that you can do calculations in 4D in the presence of this boundary and they reduce to one dimension lower holds true also when we add a variety of defects. So here I have the picture. See, you can take the four-dimensional setup, put this boundary, say on the left, take a collection of local operators of defects at the boundary, as well as other defects which are transverse perpendicular to the boundary and end on the boundary at some endpoints. These could be lines, they could be topological boundaries ending on corners, on two-dimensional corners. And this path integral will reduce to a three-dimensional path integral involving three-dimensional holomorphic BF theory with perturbative local operators or perturbative defects whenever I had boundary operators or boundary defects, non-perturbative local operators whenever I had lines, this is in red, boundary holomorphic boundary conditions whenever I had two-dimensional corners, and so on and so forth. So you can sort of encapsulate a whole complicated setup in four dimensions within the three-dimensional holomorphic topological BF theory. In particular, the sort of lines which are associated to which can end on a holomorphic topological number of conditions and that exist in the A model are something called toothed lines. Now, if you remember, Kevin, towards the end of the talk, described a way to compute the space of non-perturbative space of local operators in three-dimensional BF theory. And the strategy was to ask what the theory associated to a sphere. And classically, the phase space on a sphere is the cotangent bundle to the affine Grassmannian. And Kay was saying to find the local operators, we'll have to quantize this cotangent bundle to the affine Grassmannian. Actually, cotangent bundle to affine Grassmannian modulo the action of G of K, meaning of Lorentz series in the group. And Kay was saying, in order to find the space of local operators, we need to quantize this phase space. And in the context of the topology of the holomorphic twist of 3D equal 2, his prescription was to use geometric quantization. In general, in this setup, the choice of line for dimension will tell you which quantizations, how are you quantizing this cotangent bundle to the affine Grassmannian. And indeed, the toothed operators of the theory are associated to equivalent modules on the affine Grassmannian and sort of give you the information to this sort of quantization. And I will discuss it momentarily. So, but just to say that so the three-dimensional of the holomorphic BF theory has these non-perturbative local operators. Classically, they act as Hecke correspondences on the Higgs, on the space of Higgs bundles. They are quantizable, and the quantization is controlled by the four-dimensional setup, which has a toothed line ending on the point at the boundary. And so the endpoints of these toothed lines at the boundary will be the result of the quantization of this space of, you know, of this cotangent bundle to the finite Grassmannian modulo G of K. I'm sorry, this is probably a pretty unfamiliar picture to most of you. So please ask as many questions as you like. I think I can do better to explain it. If I get the right questions.
May I ask a question, please? So I'm familiar in the 4D GL twist into connect with 3D Chern-Simons theory, analytically continued Chern-Simons theory, for example. In that, even though you don't have Wilson lines in the bulk, just supersymmetry invariant, you have supersymmetry invariant Wilson lines at the boundary. Is there a similar situation here where you have Wilson lines?
Yes, absolutely. So I will discuss the boundary line defects momentarily.
I see. Okay.
But this too, there are. If instead of four-dimensional A twist, you had the generic acoustic invariant twist with some parameter psi, then the boundary theory would be Chern-Simons theory instead of being the holomorphic BF theory. It would be topological. And there would still be interesting holomorphic boundary conditions, two-dimensional holomorphic boundary conditions, leading to holomorphic corners within topological boundary conditions in four dimensions. That's a fun story, but I will not discuss it today at all. Today I'm going to focus on the A twist, where you, instead of getting a Chern-Simons theory, you get this holomorphic BF theory.
Davide, I'm sorry to lose. On this point, so Witten's story about Kovanov homology was look at your blue picture vertically. That would be the cigar direction. It ended at topological boundary conditions. So on the green, it would create Chern-Simons theory. And then the H.T. Neumann would create the holomorphic boundary condition for that Chern-Simons.
Sorry. If you want to have an analogy with that, you will be in generic twist, not in A twist. And then the Chern-Simons theory will be the analog of holomorphic topological BF theory. So it will be vertical. And then the Dirichlet boundary conditions at the bottom or something like that will create, or non-Nampo boundary conditions will create a Kac-Moody algebra or a W algebra at the corner. Here you can do the same. You can take this holomorphic BF theory. You can put the Dirichlet boundary conditions at the bottom. And as I will discuss in a couple of slides, this gives you critical level Kac-Moody algebra or classical W algebras, which are chiral algebras with a very large center, which is the reason, if you want, the boundary condition has to be holomorphic topological instead of being topological. Because the center of the two-dimensional local operators is going to be local operators that can be moved away from the corner. And here, the operators that can be moved along the holomorphic BF, holomorphic Neumann boundary condition. So this is analogous to sort of Nekrasov-Witten statement construction, but you only turn on one omega deformation parameter and not two, so you get an A twist instead of getting a general Kac-Moody-Witten twist. Any other questions?
Yeah, could I ask a question?
Sure.
So one thing that I've learned from your wonderful paper with Tudor and Kevin, is that holomorphic BF theory arises as, maybe even this is Kevin's earlier paper, but holomorphic BF theory arises as the zero level limit of Chern-Simons.
Yes.
Should I put this into your story as the A-twist being the same limit of the general psi?
And yes.
This is sort of the family of deformable boundary conditions you were talking about before.
Yes.
Or, yeah. And then perhaps you'll get to this next, but what's the other limit? The psi goes to infinity limit? Or it'll be an E-twist thing, but.
So.
I know like these sorts of limits show up a lot on boundary vertex algebras.
If you wanted to get like W-algebras, if you wanted to get W-algebras in generic twist, you would put Neumann on the left and Nam on the bottom. If you don't, if you go to psi equal to zero, Neumann becomes holomorphic topological Neumann. And Dirichlet and Nam remains topological Nam. In the other hand, if you go to k equal to infinity, Neumann remains a topological Neumann, but Nam becomes the holomorphic topological Nam, which I will discuss in two slides.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So you have a W algebra in the corner, and it has two classical limits. One when kappa goes to infinity, other when kappa goes to zero. In those limits, it gains a large center, and the center lives either as vertical local operators on the vertical plane or local operators on the horizontal plane, depending if kappa is zero or infinity.
Oh, that's really cool. Okay, great. I'll wait two slides then.
Any other questions? Okay. So B-twist, actually one slide, B-twist. Sorry, there was something on, somehow a slide disappeared, I think. Okay. So there was something I wanted to say about the BF theory, which is that calculations in the homomorphic BF theory require perturbative calculations, meaning there are loop corrections to a lot of quantities in holomorphic BF theory. These are very, very interesting, very important. And it takes some effort to compute them or how to learn how to deal with them. And so before I discuss them, I want to discuss the B model version 2S dual of this boundary condition. So the S dual of Neumann is Nam. And so that's why I want to devote a slide to discuss the holomorphic topological Nam pole boundary condition in the B-twisted four-dimensional gauge theory. Because I'm going to find structures from purely classical calculations, which then I want to match with quantum calculations on the A side. So the Nam pole boundary condition in the twisted theory works as following. The phase space, classically, the phase space of the B-twisted theory is the space of flat connections in three dimensions. And I want to define a nice boundary condition in there. The boundary condition is that I want the flat connection in the holomorphic direction to be an upper, which is covariantly constant in the topological direction. So, this I think this last condition is correct. I hope I got it right. I should have double checked. But at the very, for sure, I want it to be an upper in the holomorphic directions.
Okay. Can you explain why? I mean, is it easy to see that it's an upper?
So the way it works is the following. The Nam pole boundary condition essentially is modeled. So I mean, I want to say properly. So there are some BPS equations, the equations of motions of the twisted theory. These are in a sense, the BPS equations of the physical theory contain a certain collection of complex equations and a sort of a real equation, a determined equation, modulo unitary gauge transformations. And typically you can you convert this into a problem with just the holomorphic equations, modulo complexified gauge transformations. Now, the full set of BPS equations have a solution called the NumPole solution, where three scalar fields get a certain expectation value, which blows up the boundary in a specific way. This singularity can be eliminated by a complexified gauge transformation. So in the twisted theory, you don't need to think about a singular, any singular fields. But the gauge transformation which does that is singular itself, meaning that some fields which were allowed to become constant, to go to some finite value at the boundary, after you do this singular gauge transformation, have to go to zero at the boundary in a specific way. And so an alternative way to think about that is that you can consider parallel transport from the boundary to some point away from the boundary. And this parallel transport is singular and sort of builds up a flag inside your fundamental representation.
Yeah, no, I like this explanation, but is it easy to see that somehow you have this Grisha's transversality condition if you think about it this way?
I think so. I mean, we derived it in a paper with Witt, and the paper on knot theory.
Okay.
So at the time, we were trying to study the 5D BPS equations, and we deformed the boundary condition to an upper boundary condition in order to get a better handle on them. But the derivation is there. And so this flag condition, the existence of this sort of flag gives you a local definition of an upper flat connection. So it is let me just describe it for SL2. For SL2, a flat connection is an upper if I can find an holomorphic section S such that the holomorphic derivative del S satisfies this equation, S where the S equal to 1. So S is a section of the two-dimensional associated bundle tensor k to the minus 1/2. So this equation makes sense. Once you have this condition, you discover that the second derivative of S is proportional to S itself. And the proportionality is what's called the classical stress tensor, and is essentially generates the local operators, the observables at the boundary. So the boundary, so the bosonic boundary observables at this upper boundary condition are just polynomials in T and its derivatives. If you compactify everything on the Riemann surface C, from the two-dimensional point of view, the space of these open flat connections is a nice complex Lagrangian manifold in the space of all flat connections. And it defines, because it's a complex manifold, you can define a B-brain, which is supported on that. And then the endomorphisms of this B-brain will be holomorphic forms on this open moduli space. The holomorphic functions are generated by this T. And then there is a fermionic partner of T, which leads in Gauss number one, and which gives you the forms on the open manifold. So the local operators on this holomorphic twist NUM are T and its derivatives and its polynomials, as well as a fermionic partner of T and its derivatives and polynomials thereof. For other gauge groups, you get more complicated constraints involving some other sections or some appropriate associated bundles with more complicated constraints on the derivatives. And you end up with essentially a classical, you end up with bosonic operators which look like a classical Lagrange algebra, as well as fermionic partners. I can say more about this momentarily. Now, I want to stress that these local operators form an holomorphic topological factorization algebra with interesting brackets. And so this whole structure should be kept in mind when we discuss this holomorphic topological non-pole boundary condition. I don't know how well the holomorphic factorization algebra structure on the space of holomorphic forms on the open manifold has been studied, but it should definitely be important for the quantum field theory perspective on geometric landmass. The section S itself can play the role. So if I go back to the picture I had, if now you think about the blue thing as the B twist and the boundary condition as the non-pole boundary condition, then T is something that I would look like this blue dot. It's a local operator that gives the boundary. And then you could ask if there are topological lines in the bulk which have nice endpoints as well. Now, the natural topological lines in the B model are Wilson lines. Intuitively, they're labeled by representations of the group. A better perspective is that they are objects in a category, which is whatever category appears on one side of the derived Satake correspondence. And each of these Wilson lines can end on the boundary on a whole space of possible endpoints. There's a whole vector space of possible endpoints for a line at the boundary. And if you take a set Chu and a fundamental representation Wilson line, the natural endpoint will be this S section. And you can get other endpoints as derivatives of S or multiplying by polynomials in T and its derivatives. For a general group or representation, you will get these sort of associated generalizations of S. You can think about them as sort of holomorphic sections or holomorphic forms valued in the universal bundle on the open manifold at the point associated to the representation for the Wilson line. These endpoints form a factorization module for the holomorphic topological factorization algebra. In particular, the action of the fermion, the brackets of the fermionic generators give you things like the action of diffeomorphisms. So in particular, these endpoints form a D module on C. So there should be a nice functor that maps the direct attack category of representations of the group into the space of possible endpoints, into this sort of collection of holomorphic topological factorization modules for the factorization algebra of local operators. And the modules on the Riemann surface are definitely well understood. I don't know if the holomorphic factorization perspective is well understood. The holomorphic factorization algebras, holomorphic topological factorization algebras in three dimensions have nice degree shifted Poisson brackets, and so one can use the fermionic generators to define symmetries on the space of local operators. These include the diffeomorphisms of C, holomorphic vector fields on C, as well as presumably some Heigertag-Muller analog of that. For when the group is not a set two. I would love to know more about that, but I have not looked at it in detail.
So this n for FC, what's the easy way to see it should be the minus one half differential?
Well, so if you want S wedge DS to make sense, to be equal to one to make sense, and so S.
I understood that part, but okay, then maybe my question is why these Wilson loop, Wilson lines and the boundary gives this S.
So the Wilson line is a parallel transport And in order to, for the Wilson line to end somewhere, you need to pick a, you need to be able to define a parallel transport from a point away from the boundary to the boundary. And because of the singular solutions I was mentioning, this parallel transport is potentially singular and has to be renormalized. So S should be thought of as a renormalized parallel transport from the boundary to a point away from the boundary. So a certain component of the, you know, so that the it's the fastest growing component of the matrix of parallel transport from the boundary to a point away from the boundary. And in order to define it, you need to sort of strip off this exponential growth. And sorry, I said wrong. It's the section of, so S is sort of the line which, when transported to the boundary, goes to zero the fastest. So that defines it. And then it has to be normalized in some way. And when you do the normalization, you you sort of introduce this k to one half twist. It's a result of the sort of this normalization procedure defines the regularized transport from the boundary.
I see. Thank you.
Any other questions? Sorry, there was some. It was just a background noise. Okay.
I have a question. If this, yeah, it is possible. Yeah. I understand that the upper condition in your paper with Witten, in that case, the upper condition could be recast as beta equations for the Godin model. So in this, for this holomorphic topological norm condition, is it the same thing or something else?
I think it's the same thing.
Okay, thank you.
But I would have to think about the, a bit more to say something useful. Yeah, no, I think it's the same thing. You know, remember that of that equation that we derived control the semi-classical limit of conformal blocks for Virasoro, which is reasonable to have in this situation. We took the sort of the k to zero limit of a setup with Virasoro at the corner. Okay. So we have this nice holomorphic perturbation algebra structure with holomorphic perturbation modules, which are the image of one side of the derived static correspondence. Now we would like to see the same thing on the A side. So we should have the same space of local operators, same collection of lines and endpoints, and same sort of functor. Hopefully compatible with the derived static correspondence, which is supposed to be as duality of line defects in four-dimensional gauge theory. Now, what are classically the local operators on the for the holomorphic BF theory are just gauge invariant polynomials in the B of the BF theory. So the BF theory has this adjoint field B, which is a one form on C. And you can take gauge invariant polynomials of that. And those are at three level, the bosonic local operators in the theory. There are also some fermionic partners, so you replace one of the Bs with the holomorphic derivative of the Gauss. So it's something like, you know, if I have trace of B squared, I will also have trace of B del C as an operator on the boundary, which actually is the stress tensor. These polynomials in B are essentially the classical Kitchen-Hamiltonians in the space of its bundles. So the phase space is the space of Higgs bundles, phi compact final surface C. And then these Gauss invariant local operators are just functions on the space of Higgs bundles, which happen to be commuting Hamiltonians, just pretty much just because operators placed at different points on the curve commute in a topological, in a homomorphic topological setup. Now, it is expected that as we can quantize the space of Higgs bundles, it should be possible to also quantize the Hessian Hamiltonians to obtain some differential operators that are called quantum Hessian Hamiltonians, and are some essentially, which are roughly gauge invariant polynomials of the quantized version of B. See, in this homomorphic BF theory, B is the conjugate variable to the bundle, to the connection of the bundle. And so when you quantize, P wants to become an infinite derivative along the space of bundles. And so the quantization of a polynomial in B should be some globally defined differential operator on the space of bundles with some appropriate twist, which is the result of some one-loop calculation. And it is a fact, a beautiful fact, with that this space of global defined local differential operators on the space of bundles gives you a collection of commuting differential operators, which are in one-to-one correspondence with the original Hitchin Hamiltonians. This fact is frankly utterly mysterious at first sight, because if you just quantize by hand 3D BF theory, holomorphic BF theory, you start computing loop corrections to your differential and holomorphic propositional algebra structure, in principle, the differential can be corrected. You could have loop corrections which map the fermionic operators to the bosonic operators and kill everything. So the fact that this does not happen is a non-trivial fact. We can try to explain this fact, we can try to verify this fact. You know, it's a matter of, it's a sort of formality theorem. You need to compute some Feynman diagrams and show that you vanish. But it's hard to motivate sort of abstractly without going to the sort of reasoning which also leads to its duality. At least I don't know how in the moment. But if these loop corrections are not there, and they don't modify, at least there are no corrections to the differential, but only to the brackets, then it's a fact that these quantum Hessian Hamiltonians are precisely the same as holomorphic functions on the space of Hoppers for the dual group. And if you include the fermionic partners, presumably you get the holomorphic forms on the space of Hopper. So the space of local operators with quantum corrections on the A side seems to match the space of local operators on the B model, B model side. Now there is a sort of a trick to argue on the A model side that we are getting the correct thing, which is to follow what Kevin was proposing in his talk, which is to introduce a boundary for the holomorphic BF theory, study the boundary local operators of holomorphic BF theory, and then find the bulk operators as the derived center of that. And I will get to that momentarily. That's a way to sort of bypass a lot of the loop calculations and get an answer. But still, the fact that things work, it's a bit of miracle just from the A-model perspective.
As a practicality, I think the tech team here needs to break the talk up into two parts. So, if you would like to take a very short break at some point.
Okay, very soon I can take a break. Okay, so the question I would like to pose to the mathematical audience is it known, perhaps in some other form, that the functions on the forms on the space of Hoppers and local operator, perturbative local operators of Lomov-BF theory match not just as a vector space, but as an holomorphic factorization algebra. I think that would be a nice statement to prove. And
I'm confused. What kind of forms of Norpers do you take? So I'm confused. Do you take functions of Norpers or something else?
The endomorphisms of the Norpers is like under some manifold. So I think that includes all forms, all holomorphic forms on the space of Norpers.
Sorry, endomorphisms. I see. You take the endomorphisms of the structure C for Norpers inside quasi-coherent sheaves on local systems. Is that
yes.
That's what you do. And you want to match it with what?
With the local operators in the holomorphic topological BF theory.
Well, my first question would be whether that is defined mathematically.
Momentarily, we'll see that it can be computed as the derived center of Kac-Moodle. I thought a little bit confused of if the holomorphic topological factorization algebra structure can be derived from that statement.
That would be somehow the first question. So somehow my first question would be how to define this holomorphic topological factorization algebra. I'm not saying it's impossible, but just on the spot, I don't understand how to do it carefully.
Yeah, that's right. Indeed, I find it a bit confusing. So I thought that defining the bulk operators as the derived center would be enough to find the holomorphic factorization algebra, holomorphic topological factorization algebra structure, but I'm reconsidering that statement because, in a sense, the holomorphic topological factorization algebra structure knows about things like the action of diffeomorphisms on C, and I don't see how that can come out of the derived center of Kac-Moodle. But I might be, I don't know. I would love to discuss this.
Yeah, I'm missing something fundamental. I don't see why a priori you should expect this thing to be holomorphic topological factorization algebra.
Well, because it's the local operators with dimensional holomorphic topological theory.
Okay, no, but if you think about it as a derived center, then...
No, that's right. That is the thing that confuses me now. So as a vector space, it should definitely be the derived center. But I'm not sure. I'm not sure as a holomorphic factorization algebra.
Wait, and on the Norpers side, how is it defined how do you define this thing as a holomorphic topological factorization algebra? So.
I'm not sure. One would have to do the topological, so the descent to just compute the Eiger operations in the four-dimensional B-twisted theory. I'm not sure. Yeah, I don't know of shortcuts. But it's a classical calculation. It should be doable.
You somehow need to make it live in three dimensions. Okay, let's forget about which directions. Holomorphic, which topological, but somehow at least it should somehow live in dimension three rather than dimension two. And so.
Yes, that's right. So you take this open boundary condition for the four dimensional theory. This is the three dimensional holomorphic topological boundary condition in the B-twist. And it should be possible to compute the factorization of transactions. So I'm looking at field.
No, I mean, this is definitely a very good mathematical question, but somehow, I mean, the question you're asking right now is too advanced for the mathematicians. Somehow, the real question would be how to define the algebra structure on both sides. And
yes,
then,
yes. That's right. Well, so in a sense, I know that on the A side, I know the definition. So, so one can write down the BVI action for holomorphic topological theory and compute Feynman diagrams to find the holomorphic topological operations. So I can give you the structure in the same way, in the same sense as Concievich could give you the quantization of a Poisson manifold as a sum over Feynman diagrams. But that seems a painful way to think about it. I would hope that there are better ways. So right, so within the BV formalism, this can be computed in perturbation theory. I assume that perhaps if the algebra, if the structure is sufficiently rigid, maybe one can do something like Kevin has done in other examples. You compute maybe a couple of Feynman diagrams, and that's enough to determine everything. But I don't know if that's the case. I would love to know more about this holomorphic topological factorization algebras in general. Okay, so perhaps I can just say one a couple of things and we can have the break. Right, this is just repeating something I was mentioning briefly before, that we should just be able to match not just the holomorphic factorization algebra, but the whole collection of holomorphic factorization modules which are in the image of the Dirac-Satake categories. So on the B model side, you just take this sort of generalizations of the section as labeled by a general representation or whatever you do for the right stuff. On the A model side, you have this phase space associated to a sphere, which is this tower of Feingrass-Mannian modulo G of K. And you had this Hecke correspondence. These sort of things act as Hecke correspondences on the space of bundles. And this is something you can quantize looking at the modules from the Feingrass-Mannian. And you get sort of the Hecke correspondences on the space of the module, on the category of the modules. And these are the modules on C. So that's a little piece of the holomorphic factorization module structure. And it should be possible to sort of extend this to the full picture. I feel that a lot of mathematical results can be sort of collected together into one compact three-dimensional statement. Okay, let's take a break now.
Thanks, Simon. It'll just be a very short break. We'll just come back in 2 minutes for quality sake at 11:10 local time. We'll skip so they can finish at 11:30.
Sorry, I have a very stupid question. I forgot what BF stands for.
BF. So if you look at the action, so there are these to kill me and the connection and its ghosts, partners. And F is just the field strength. So B, the action is called, it's called BF theory because the action is literally trace of B times F.
Okay, thank you.
So the equation of motion for B makes F flat. Right, and the equation of motion for A makes B flat section in the joint.
Davide?
Mm-hmm.
May I ask you a question regarding what you were saying about OPERs and so on? Mm-hmm. So would it make sense to begin with in 6D? And Kapustin-Witten would compactify it first on a torus and then on C and get a two-dimensional theory. So what if you compactify it first on a circle and then on C, then you would get a 3D theory. Naively, I would presume that its target space is what you call Hitchin systems, whatever, the hyperkähler manifold associated with connections on C. And so then you would see two categories associated to it rather than a category. OPERs would be one of the objects on the B side because it's a holomorphic Lagrangian. So for example, you may consider the category of its endomorphisms, which would be coherent sheaves on OPERs. Yes. But then it's not quite clear what is the S dual since you don't have a torus.
Not a side, there is no S dual. But there is a, now there is an homomorphic topological factorization as well structure in four dimensions, presumably.
I'm sorry?
So now if you uncompactify C,
mm-hmm.
then you presumably have a four dimensional homomorphic topological factorization algebra structure. Instead of a three-dimensional one.
If you uncompactify C, it will be five-dimensional.
Yes, but if you put this open boundary condition, the open boundary condition will support a four-dimensional holomorphic topological factorization algebra.
I'm sorry. Are you saying that if I compactify six-dimensional theory on a circle, then
yes.
there is a boundary condition, which is four-dimensional.
Yes.
This boundary condition, but where will the OPERs come from? You still need C as a factor of the five-dimensional.
No, the notion of OPER does not require C to be a compact Riemann surface. The OPERs are a local notion, so you can define them anyway.
So you need your five-dimensional manifold to be C cross something three-dimensional.
No. So the notion of OPER is local.
But you formulate it on a two-dimensional surface.
I'm just saying it's a boundary condition which depends holomorphically on one direction and topologically on the others.
So you say that in five-dimensional theory, there will be a four-dimensional boundary with a special boundary condition associated with the notion of OPERs.
Yes.
And if you, for example, sandwich these two walls, then you get a four-dimensional theory of the type that you consider here.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And by the way, going to 5D and then putting the open boundary condition is just the same as staying in 6D and doing omega formation. So you're really talking about the sort of the what lives in the 6D theory if I do one omega formation.
But then you will lose two dimensions as
yes. And so you get something four dimensional.
And how is that related to OPERs? Is that the...
Well, it will be the same space of local operators.
We should start again and maybe finish the initial rest of the talk and then have a discussion afterwards.
Yeah, it's funny. I thought I would have too little material and instead I might have a bit too much. That's good. So, right, I wanted to briefly describe how you can use boundary conditions for the trivi theory in order to study the system. So this is a situation where we have an holomorphic boundary condition in 3D, which becomes a corner in 4D. And it's a boundary condition, which is, it's a Dirichlet boundary condition in 3D, and it becomes a corner between holomorphic topological Neumann and topological Dirichlet in 4D. So at the Dirichlet boundary condition, you fix the connection to some value. So you fix a bundle, if you want, on C. And you're left with just B at the boundary. And B behaves as a current, as a Kasmudic current at critical level. So this boundary condition supports a critical Kasmudic algebra. The operators in the center of the critical Kasmudic algebra are expected to be operators that can be brought away from the corner and into the three-dimensional homomorphic topological theory. And so you get this statement that the quantum Hessian Hamiltonians are realized as the center of the critical Kasmudic algebra. And there is a derived version of that too. You consider the derived center, and then you get also fermionic things. You can also think about toothed lines, which instead of lying in the bulk, lie on top of the green boundary condition. This is what you encounter if you study the sort of non-perturbative boundary local operators, as Kevin was doing. In that case, instead of having the equivariant Grassmannian, you just have the Grassmannian. These boundary toothed lines control the quantization of the Grassmannian and are labeled by the modules on the Grassmannian. And so there is a functor from the modules on the Grassmannian to modules for the Kasmudi algebra, which are called spectral flow modules. And so this picture makes sense. I have my toothed line on the green boundary, and it ends on some local operators, and it's a functor from the modules on the Grassmannian to modules for the three-dimensional factorization algebra, which is the Kasmudi algebra. And you can even try to figure out under which conditions the toothed line can move away from the boundary. And you can encounter a notion of average spectral flow module, which has a relation to Hecke operators and satisfies this sort of open differential equations, as was shown. I don't know. I guess it goes back to, I don't know who realized this first, but it's a thing that's been observed multiple times, that these average spectral flow operators satisfy the upper differential equation. I saw it, for example, in a paper by Teschner from a few years ago on Lyman's. So using this perspective, one can hope to bypass some of the calculations about local operators in the three-dimensional DF theory, at the very least to find the space of local operators as vector space, as we were discussing before the break. It's not quite clear to me that you can get also the holomorphic factorization algebra structure, holomorphic topological factorization algebra structure. I would like to know to understand that better. Perhaps I can sharpen the puzzle a little bit by considering an alternative boundary condition. Instead of topological Dirichlet in the A model, we can take topological NAM in the A model. So that instead of Kasmudi algebras, we're talking about classical W algebras. I will just go through this slide quickly. This topological NAM pole boundary condition essentially corresponds to the Hitchin section in the phase space, in the Hitchin moduli space. It supports the chiral algebra, which is the Drenfeld circle of reduction of critical Kasmudi, I think. And it's just the classical W algebra. In a sense, you see T, you know, you see this classical stress tensor right there. And then I assume when you take the derived center, you find both T itself and some fermionic partner. but it's not quite clear to me how to see that the fermionic partner generates the thermal physics of the surface, which will be part of the holomorphic factorization algebra structure, holomorphic topological factorization algebra structures. Anyway, a good feature of this topological non-pole boundary condition is that we know it's a dual, and it's simple. It's a topological Neumann boundary condition on the B-model side. And it's another way to understand the relation between W algebras and all functions on the open manifold. Anyway, not much I want to say here. Another thing I should mention that might help you read some literature is that there is a, so as I said, the Dirichlet boundary condition also has a known as dual, but is it complicated as dual, hard to describe and hard to do calculations with. But there is a trick which allows you to realize a sort of to mimic the Dirichlet boundary condition by a non-pole boundary condition enriched by line defects. And this leads to the sort of mathematical technology called separation of variables. So it gives you an alternative way to think about the modules on the space of bundles. So it gives you a different polarization of the Ricci moduli space. So the different way to quantize it. Okay, let me see. Right, I was asked about Wilson lines in the holomorphic topological Neumann boundary condition. Yes, it supports Wilson lines. They go to Wilson lines in the three-dimensional DFT theory, and they can end at the Kac-Moody corner to give you one modules for the critical Kac-Moody algebra. And these are as dual to boundary toothed lines in the non-pole holomorphic topological non-pole boundary condition on the B side, which correspond to looking to opers with singularities of trivial monotony. And you know, this sort of picture can lead you to the you know, the nice statements about the Gödel model and the you know, the Bethe equation for the Gödel model and opers with singularities of trivial monotony.
Can I ask you something?
Yes.
For the Gödel model, we need the ramifications coming from the surface defects, and it looks like it has to be some line defect in the 3D VF theory.
Yes, that's the next slide.
I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. So, boundary lines in 4D give you lines in 3D, but the opposite is not true, not necessarily true. Lines in 3D might require some thinking about, you know, some quantization prescription, and in that case, they will come from surfaces in four dimensions. So there is a beautiful two category of surface defects in four-dimensional EMS theory, which is what the topological field theory associates to a circle. And the S-duality of these should be what's called local geometric Langlands. These surface defects can meet boundaries along lines. Particularly, they can meet the homologous topological Neumann along band topological lines. If you put one of these surface defects to wrap this whole picture, you will get a Verma module at the corner, or something like a Verma module. I mean, you see, if you put a surface defect in this picture, you need to pick a line along Neumann boundary condition, but also a line along the topological boundary condition. And I could say words like D modules on the affine flag. And then you have some functor which takes a boundary line on Neumann and a D module on the affine flag and spits out a module for the Kac-Moody algebra, for the critical Kac-Moody algebra. Anyway, so you can play games with local geometric Langlands as well. And both with regular or wild ramification. And you can look at the S-dual, and the S-dual of the surface defects is typically known. And you also have the local geometric Langland conjecture. And you can study the corresponding intersections with the non-pole boundary conditions and ramified opers and whatnot. Actually, until wait until what time? 11:45 or 12? Because I'm speeding up, but perhaps I shouldn't speed up.
Well, yeah, technically, you have another 5-ish minutes, but you go a little bit over because you have a break.
No, I'm just trying to remember. Sorry, what did you say is the end time?
The official ending time was 11:30, David.
11:30. Okay, then I should speed up. Good.
Yeah.
Perfect. So now, until now, I sort of describe your constructions, which should just reorganize in an interesting way some non-mathematical results, perhaps extend them a little bit. I would like now to discuss a setup which perhaps has not been as developed, which is related, associated with the point that Neumann boundary conditions are not the only holomorphic topological boundary conditions one can construct in the A model. As I said, these deformable boundary conditions are rare, but they are not, but there are some. In particular, there are holomorphic topological interfaces between UN and UM gauge theories. And these ones satisfy some relations similar to these, where you have a UN gauge theory on one side and UM on the other, and an interface in between, and is equivalent to holomorphic BF theory for a supergroup, for UN slash M. So it should be possible to study holomorphic BF theory for UN slash M, study the local operators, the tooth lines, the endpoints of tooth lines, Hecke correspondences, and whatnot. And then these boundary conditions have been known as dual. This dual depends a little bit sensitively on N being equal to M or bigger than N. If N is equal to M, you get some interesting complex Lagrangian manifold, complex Lagrangian correspondence between GLN and GLN flat connections, which is defined as follows. You keep the same underlying bundle, but you shift the holomorphic connection by a rank one matrix. I thought this is an XY, built from a fundamental and anti-fundamental holomorphic sections of the underlying bundle. If N is greater than M, there is a kind of a partial Hopper boundary condition where you sort of break down your GLN to GLM by a small dumpole, and then you identify this remaining N by N block with the flat connection on the other side of the interface. Anyway, that is just to say that there are some B twisted interfaces which are easy to define, and they're conjecturally as dual to this UN slash N sort of interface on the A side. And so it should be possible to study again, you know, holomorphic forms on these B type boundary conditions, local operators, endpoints of lines, and give it a holomorphic topological factorization algebra and match it to the A side. And I don't know what are the mathematical implications, but it might be interesting. It's kind of a mirabolic version of the usual story, using the language that I learned from Sasha, and perhaps I'm using it improperly here because Sasha used it in the context of topological boundary conditions and interfaces, and here I'm using it on the holomorphic topological side. But anyway, there are also orthosymplectic generalizations of these, as well as some exceptional examples, I believe, although I don't understand them very well. Okay, but just to say, so there is a certain list of holomorphic topological pairs of boundary conditions, and it's worth checking how well do they match. There are also a large collection of topological boundary conditions besides the ones I described. Essentially, you can build, there are things called enriched Neumann boundary conditions, which can be built just by coupling a three-dimensional linear four theory with symmetry G to your four-dimensional theory. If you understand a three-dimensional theory, it's pretty easy to understand these four-dimensional boundary conditions. You can get, now, for example, if you know the bound derivatives algebras, you will know what the corner is with holomorphic Neumann, and so on and so forth. There are a lot of examples from string theory, and I believe that what has been studied as in terms of spherical varieties in mathematical literature must be a whole other collection of examples that we didn't know about of an enriched normal boundary conditions coupled to hypermultiplets, which happen to be as dual to each other. Okay, here was the intermission. I was going to talk about analytic geometric Langevin next. And perhaps I would just say two words, that is, you can do a funny construction where you take holomorphic topological boundary condition and anti-holomorphic topological boundary conditions. This definitely brings you out of the realms of algebraic geometry and into analysis. And it leads to the idea of quantizing the phase space as an act, you know, actually quantizing the phase space, actually quantizing the Hitchy moduli space and getting Hilbert spaces and self-adjoint operators and you know, spectral problems. And this is the work of analytic geometric Langevins. You can get, you know, actually, you can get a Hilbert space, which roughly looks like a pseudo-normalizable functions from the space of bundles. You can get an action of the quantum Hitchy Hamiltonians and their conjugate living on the two boundaries, as well as Hecke operators coming from toothed lines stretched between the boundaries. And it's a beautiful, fast story. And then you get a sort of an eigenvalue problem for these Hitchy Hamiltonians, which is solved by S-duality. Because on the S-duality side, now you get sort of an open and anti-open manifold, and the space of states is essentially labeled by opers, by flat connections, which happen to be both an oper and an anti-oper. And here you get all this work by, I mean, it's a way to get from physics to this work by on analytic geometric Langevins. And yeah, and you can also use topological boundary conditions to create interesting states, states which have predictable properties under the action of these Hitchy Hamiltonians or Hecke operators. It's an interesting construction. And there is a real version of this where you study the quantization of some spaces of real bundles on a real surface and so on and so forth. And yes, anyway, then I had a whole bunch, I had some very concrete examples which are supposed to illustrate the fact that although the physics gives you analytic geometric Langevins on complex numbers or on real numbers and allows you to compute interesting things, the resulting calculations often use quantities which can be defined over other fields too. And you end up finding statements which are true over other fields. And I find this deeply mysterious because I don't know how to define conformal, you know, I don't know how to define vertex algebras over other fields, but somehow the correlation functions of these vertex algebras can be defined over other fields and still have reasonable properties. Anyway, I think I should conclude here.
All right, are there any more questions? I hope that came through.
Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Can I ask you something?
Oh.
Yes, sure.
So you mentioned about the eigenvalue of the Hecke operator, but perhaps we can think of the local version of it, just eigenvalue for the Hecke modification, not the integrated version of it.
Okay.
I'm just asking whether that's also thinkable.
I mean, the Hecke modification, right, so you can create, so the Hecke modification not integrated over is a boundary toothed line. So you can definitely try to use the band, the Riclemanary condition to define a state, and then you can modify the state by these Hecke modifications. But effectively, what you're doing is okay. This the state you're creating is essentially a distribution over some bundle. So you know it's a delta function distribution at one point of band G. If you do Hecke modification of that without integrating over the space of Hecke modifications, well, you're just doing a delta function at the position of the modified band. If it doesn't gain you something new. If you do the same with numpole toy, it's a bit more interesting because see the numpole boundary conditions, topological numpole boundary conditions, try to create distributions which are not supported over band. That's sort of a reminder, a very stark reminder of the fact that the description as a true normalizable functions on band G is working because the two normalizable functions are very forgiving. But in order to define nice self-adjoint operators, typically you need to have some spatial distribution and some Schwarz space. And the spaces, the right spaces of distributions of Schwarz spaces are not the ones you would naively use. And so topological boundary conditions can be used to produce distributions with interesting properties, and I think they can give you hints of what Schwarz spaces to use. And anyway, so if you do Hecke modifications of NAM, then you're sort of doing a separation of variable description where you have delta function. I mean, if you start doing enough Hecke modifications, you land on actual bundles, semi-stable bundles. Anyway, so Hecke modifications on NAM can produce a whole bunch of interesting distributions, which might be helpful in understanding what are the correct distribution of spaces to use. I don't know enough, but
another question is about this separation of variable. How do I see this description of or the changing the description of the boundary condition? How does it relate to the integration transformation? Typically, the separation of variable is integration transformation, right?
Yes. So the statement is that the Riclemanary conditions have a space of vacua. And if you move along the space of vacua, they look like numpole boundary conditions. But there are vortices, so dynamical vortices, which look like lines, and which, in a sense, the actual Riclemanary boundary condition is like the numpole boundary condition decorated by vortices in all possible ways. And it's sort of integrating over the position of vortices, I think, is one way to think about this integral transform.
Thank you.
I mean, this was pretty much, I think it's one way to interpret some work by Teschner and Gukov and others. I think I need to remind myself.
A question? Where would I find more on these interfaces between UN and UN? In terms of holomorphic BF theory for the supergroup? You mentioned this kind of at the end, but are there references? Is this recent? Is this known for a long time?
I'm not sure. So there is a similar statement for the Chern-Simons theory. This is in work of Victen and Mikhailov. So for general kappa, it has been verified that UN slash M Chern-Simons theory emerges from these interfaces. So here I'm discussing the kappa to zero limit of that. I don't know if it was written down at some point, but it's something you can argue for in the same way. So I would refer to Witten and Mikhail.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks again.